Governor Brown will sign his final state budget today. State lawmakers have a deal on internet privacy protection, too, that also needs the governor's signature. Today on Inside Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler explains the negotiations and how they impact the November ballot. The Delta breeze is gusty across California today. Have you noticed? We're going to get an update from CAL FIRE, as with this wind, there are still a number of wildfires burning across the state. McClatchy, the parent company of the Sacramento Bee, is trying to reinvent itself as a digital publishing company. I'll talk about that with freelance journalist Alan Young. He wrote a cover story about McClatchy for this month's Comstocks magazine. And later in the hour, the curtain goes up on the 9th season of the Davis Shakespeare Festival. Directors and actors from both of the summer plays are here with us. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's Today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. And so there is a decision today from the U.S. Supreme Court in the Janus case, which we've been talking about on this program recently. The 5-4 ruling in favor of Mark Janus means public sector unions can no longer require members to pay agency fees. You might guess that there are a lot of reactions, so let me read from a few of the press releases. The California Teachers Association writes, "The ruling is a radical interpretation of the First Amendment and is a sweeping paradigm shift, as it will make it more difficult for public workers to bargain collectively." A statement from the Sacramento Central Labor Council and Director Fabrizio Sazzo, "We strongly condemn today's Supreme Court decision, backed by rich and powerful billionaires and corporate elites. It is another attempt by the rich and powerful to take away working people's freedom to stand together and negotiate a fair return." From the entertainment industry, SAG-AFTRA President Gabriel Carteris said, "Wrong decision," adding that the ruling is shameful. Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler is joining us today from the Capitol. We're going to get to state government news, but Ben, let's start right there with the decision at the Supreme Court and the implications for California.
Yeah, they're big. They're big. Although I suspect they won't be quite as big for California as they might be for other states for two reasons. One, the biggest one is that Democrats control California state government and they are sympathetic to unions. And so it's unlikely you're going to see the unions get taken advantage of in government the way that might be the case elsewhere. At the same time, I think unions could be vulnerable, you know, in political races and the like because they'll have fewer resources. Now, the flip side, though, is that because unions are fairly strong here and because Democrats have controlled the government, that both camps, Democrats and unions, have really been getting ready for this ruling for years. I mean, it was expected last year, I think, until Justice Antonin Scalia passed away. And so there are, you know, budget bills that have gone through. There are provisions in law that unions and Democrats have worked out that, you know, it won't make up for the ruling. And I don't know that anything really could for unions. But unions are going to still have more advantages here, I suspect, politically and otherwise, than they do in red states.
So we've not yet seen a statement from Mark Janus in winning the case, but there's going to be reaction and analysis throughout the day on NPR. We'll also post a link to our segments, including my talk yesterday with the president of the CTA at capradio.org/insight. Ben, let's shift then to state government news. Governor Brown is in Los Angeles. He's going to sign his 16th and final state budget. That's a marker in history.
Shed a tear. Last one.
It will go into effect July 1st, but there are some interesting deals going on at the Capitol right now. He has to sign at least one of them, and it has an impact on the November ballot. So let's start there. I'm talking about the internet privacy measure.
Sure. And to be clear, he doesn't have to sign any of these deals that we're about to talk about, potential deals, but it's seen as likely that if they reach his desk, he will. So, all right, the internet privacy measure, talked about it in your absence, Beth, last week on Capitol Chat, but for folks who missed it, we're talking about an initiative that on Monday qualified for the November ballot that would give Californians new internet privacy rights. And we're talking about allowing internet users to stop companies like Facebook and Google from sharing or selling their data. It would give users the right to know what information about them businesses collect, share, and sell, and it would give them the right to delete data as well. So I caught up yesterday with the proponent of this initiative, Alistair McTaggart, who's a San Francisco real estate developer. he's not necessarily George Soros or Koch brothers wealthy, but he has enough money that he was able to spend a few million dollars and get this measure qualified. So let's hear what he had to say about what his proposal seeks to do.
It's to give Californians more control of their privacy. And so we do that three ways. We do that, the first thing is transparency, knowing what the companies are collecting about you, being able to find out, because right now you have no way of knowing what these companies are collecting about you. The second thing is control, being able to tell the companies, don't sell my personal information. And then the third thing is accountability, saying to the companies, hey, if you're going to collect all this personal information about you, keep it safe. Because, you know, identity theft is a huge problem, and we're trying to address all those three things.
So the legislation, Ben, I think is AB 375, correct?
It is, yes.
And if it is, as it's been approved by lawmakers, and if it becomes the deal of record, then the ballot measure gets removed from the November ballot, correct?
Yes. I mean, what there is there's a deal between McTaggart and a couple of lawmakers, Democratic Assemblyman Ed Chow and Democratic State Senator Bob Hertzberg, and that if this bill becomes law, that is, passes both chambers of the legislature and is signed by Governor Brown, McTaggart and his fellow proponent will sign a letter and submit it to the Secretary of State's office, withdrawing their initiative from the November ballot. Now, the deadline for the ballot to be certified, the initiatives to be certified for the November election, is tomorrow.
Right.
And so all of this has to come down by tomorrow. The final amendments on this internet privacy bill went into print about a quarter to 11 Monday morning, means the bill cannot begin to be passed until a quarter to 11 tomorrow morning. You can see that that's a pretty tight timeline. It's doable. And my best guess now is that, yes, this will become law and that the measure will not be on the ballot. But, there's going to be it's going to be a busy day tomorrow, because that's probably not the only deal that's going to get voted on and with the same situation with a potential ballot measure getting withdrawn.
Well, with what you just described, that's why I thought the governor's signature was necessary.
Absolutely is necessary. It's just not fair to say that he
has
is going.
To.
Yeah. I mean, it's up to him. But we expect him. I mean, I've gotten no guidance from his office. I've seen indications that he's been involved in both deals, the internet privacy and one that we're about to talk about involving a ban on local soda taxes. I have not seen anything that would indicate he would veto them.
Okay. All right. So let's move on to the soda tax ban deal. Explain that one.
Sure. So let's start with the fact that there's a ballot measure that is expected to qualify, I think, tomorrow, that would raise the threshold for approval of local sales tax measures from majority to two-thirds. Right now, if there's a sales tax increase for general purposes, like Sacramento's Measure U a couple years ago and the possible increase and extension of it that Mayor Steinberg has proposed for this fall, that's a majority vote. If you want to raise the sales tax specifically for an exact purpose, like police or libraries, that takes two-thirds. Well, this measure would raise everything up to two-thirds, and it would add some additional requirements in terms of transparency on how the money would be spent, trying to take away any and all loopholes that local governments and, in some cases, the state government for fees go through or seek to go through to get around a two-thirds requirement. So cities and counties, particularly cities and particularly big cities, are really nervous about this measure. They're not sure they can defeat it. And unions are too. And so SEIU, Service Employees International Union, one of the biggest and most influential unions in the state, approached the initiative proponent, the California Business Roundtable, which is a CEO's group. But also in this case, the initiative was backed very firmly by the American Beverage Association, Big Soda, you can say, which has been fighting local sales tax measures, sometimes successfully, sometimes unsuccessfully, and said, well, hey, what about a deal? What if we say for the next 12 years there are no new local soda taxes? That means existing ones like in San Francisco and Berkeley and Oakland are grandfathered in, but no new ones. Well, if we give you that, would you take your measure off the ballot? And the soda industry said, yes, yes, we will. Mm-hmm. And so that is what came together in about 24 hours from Friday afternoon to Saturday evening. Bill went into print Saturday night. Nobody had heard anything about it until then. And now we have some pretty angry people on the other side. But it does seem like this measure is going to head through and become law.
Well, Well, this is big drama at the Capitol when it happens at lightning speed like that and
yes.
late in negotiations. There's one more that we have to talk about. This one might not have as definitive an ending as the other two, but let's talk about lead paint now.
Sure. So now we move from big soda to big paint, as I saw someone coin it. I don't know the industries would appreciate these monikers,
right,
but I think
exactly.
it's kind of funny. You just add the word big to any industry or you know, we're big public radio, right? So this proposal would reverse and it's an initiative that has qualified. It qualified yesterday for the November ballot. It would reverse an appeals court ruling last year that held three paint companies liable for what could be hundreds of millions of dollars of lead paint cleanup in homes. And it would authorize a $2 billion bond at taxpayer expense to pay for cleanup projects. So on the one hand, it removes liability from the paint manufacturers. On the other, it places the responsibility for paying for the cleanup on taxpayers. Now, the industry has said all along, look, we'd rather have a legislative solution to this. We think the ruling is unfair and has some pretty big consequences. So they really want a deal, and I think they want a deal. This is my read of this. They seem to want a deal more than maybe the backers of the Internet Privacy Initiative or even potentially the soda initiative, who I think they felt they'd have a pretty good shot at winning in November. I don't know if the paint industry thinks it has a good shot at winning in November, but I suspect that they've got a challenge on their hands once an opposition campaign forms and talks about what's going on. And so they are seeking a deal. A source of mine on a completely different story quipped to me and gave me permission to use this quip that the industry may have painted itself into a corner on this one. We will see if the legislature is willing to take a deal with the industry. Let's keep in mind that because there's a 3-day in print requirement, we're past 3 days before the deadline. So whether there's a handshake deal or of some sort, that would really be the only way to get it done.
All right, just one more note. The gas tax repeal will stay on the November ballot, and I expect that's going to be the final major fight of Governor Brown's governorship. And he definitely has money in the bank to fight that one.
Yeah, nearly $15 million left over from his last gubernatorial campaign, and I'm sure he could go out and raise more if he wanted to.
So he's signing his final budget today. In that budget is money for homelessness. That's a nice segue to not only mention the budget, but mention the focus on homelessness for a number of media outlets, including Capital Public Radio tomorrow. You want to take it, Ben?
Sure. So in the budget, there is $500 million for local governments and nonprofits to address homelessness. Now, this has been talked about as a major crisis, of course, which is a big reason why we and other media outlets are having this day full of coverage tomorrow. And it's been treated with a great deal of urgency inside the legislature and the Capitol. That said, if you look at the fine print in the budget bill, the state has until January 31st of next year, so 7 months into this 12-month fiscal year that starts in July, starts next week. The government's got 7 months to get the first part of this money out and then deeper into the fiscal year to get the rest of it out. It does not have to take that long, but it can take that long, which says something about how government works, the speed of government. And the flip side is, look, if defenders would say, you want us to make sure there isn't any waste, fraud, or abuse, so we need to go through the process, make sure this gets out to the right people in the right way. And then the other piece of the budget is a ballot measure that it deals with the No Place Like Home program, which seeks to use money from raised by Proposition 63, which is a millionaire's tax that voters approved more than a decade ago, championed by Daryl Steinberg, of all people. And the money is intended to help folks who are mentally ill. And this No Place Like Home bond would take some of that money, would bond against future proceeds to the point of $2 billion, and take that money and use it to help homelessness, and specifically homelessness for folks who are mentally ill. And so that is a ballot measure that the legislature sent to the governor. Governor will sign it today with the rest of the budget. It'll be on the ballot this fall.
All right. Busy day, both in the state and nationally. Thanks so much for your time today, Ben.
Anytime.
That is Ben Adler. And you can find more state government news at capradio.org. And as Ben referenced, tomorrow is coverage of the Day of Homelessness for many news outlets across the state. You can find a number of stories on Insight and from the Cap Radio news team tomorrow. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. The Delta breeze has given us a windy morning today, and we have a triple-digit forecast ahead for the weekend. The weather, as you know, is critical right now as summer wildfires continue to burn across the state. On the phone with us for the latest is CAL FIRE's Deputy Director of Communications, Mike Mueller. Deputy Director, glad to have you with us, and I think that's a promotion, isn't it?
It is. Thank you, Beth, again, as always, having us. Yes, promoted into this position in early February.
Well, good for you. Tell me about the CAL FIRE picture across the state right now, and what's the impact of the wind this morning?
Actually, the winds right now, it's working for us right now. It's cooperating, but what we're looking at is, unfortunately, the weather forecast is we're going to return right back into a red flag conditions in a lot of these areas that have existing fires.
So let's talk about the Pawnee Fire in particular in Lake County. What are the latest statistics?
So right now the Pawnee Fire is at 13,500 acres. We have 25% containment. We still have about 600 structures that are threatened. And again, unfortunately, we had 22 that were destroyed and 4 that were damaged.
There have been a number of evacuation orders in place. What's the status of those orders?
Well, we still have evacuation areas along what we call Old Long Valley Road, New Long Valley Road, and north of Highway 20. They're still under advisory under Walker Ridge area and Wilbur Springs. But again, our priority out there is to get people back to their homes.
Yeah. Tell me about the structures that were burned and the homes. I know something that's been important in this fire is the direction that it's been moving.
Yes, yes. In fact, it was moving north east of Clear Lake Oaks. The fire made a pretty heavy push yesterday towards the north. And again, fire conditions out there are explosive. So any residents in those areas, they need to be vigilant, pay attention to any type of release. But we still have active fire.
And some homes are among the 22 buildings that were lost, correct?
That is correct.
So at this point, is this fire overlapping any of the previous burn areas? Because I know that's been a focal point for CAL FIRE over the last few fire seasons.
Yeah, no, this one actually has been, it does have some fire history, but not of the recent fires within the past 4 to 5 years. But there is fire history out in these areas. We call them old burns that they've gone into. Where we're seeing different vegetation types because of they were involved in earlier fires, but they are crossing into some old burns.
That is Deputy Director of Communications Mike Mueller for CAL FIRE. I think I counted 8 active fires on your map this morning. Tell me about the number across the state, and is the Pawnee the largest at the moment?
Well, right now, as far as active across the state, we have a total of 6 fires, the Pawnee being the largest. And the second largest fire would be the Lane Fire. That's over 3,800 acres. Crews had a great success with weather cooperation yesterday, and that one's at 65% containment, and that is in Tehama County.
Okay. What else should we know going into this weekend? You mentioned the red flag warning. I think we can't say it enough, but putting ourselves into best practice in light of that is always the challenge.
It is, Beth, and that is a great point. Unfortunately, what we saw in 2017 is, you know, it was a history-making, devastating wildfire year. And people continue to say the term new normal. Well, the new is it's not new anymore. This is the normal. And when we issue fire weather watches, fire weather warnings, or red flag warnings, Californians need to be prepared. There is no more fire season. We continue to preach this, but you need to treat those warnings and watches just like they would back east on a hurricane advisory. You need to be prepared. You need to prepare with your family. You need to do it early. Because this is the normal, and these are the conditions we're going to see statewide.
Okay, and again, the Pawnee Fire at 25% containment right now. That is Deputy Director of Communications Mike Mueller for CAL FIRE. So glad to have you with us again today, Mike. Good luck to you and everyone out there this weekend.
Thanks again, Beth.
And we'll continue to keep you updated on the fire situation. We'll also post a link to CAL FIRE's information page. That's at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Are you still subscribing to the Sacramento Bee? And do you get the paper version, or do you have a digital subscription? You probably have followed the news about the layoffs, the departures at the Bee this past April. They all prompted talk that someday there won't be a paper in Sacramento, and that the future of the once mighty McClatchy Publishing Company is more uncertain than it's ever been. Freelance reporter Alan Young broke the news of the Bee's layoffs this spring, and this month he has a cover story in Comstock's magazine. It's about the change McClatchy is undergoing. Hi, Alan.
Hey,
always
Beth,
a pleasure to have you here on Insight. So change doesn't seem to be an adequate word for what's going on. Am I right about that?
Yeah, change to put it lightly. So the best way to think about what's going on with McClatchy is they are transforming from a newspaper company to a high-tech company. They're in this cocoon stage right now, and it's coming at a time when they've lost 60% of their revenue since 2007, 60%. The SACB newsroom is down 63% since 2006. So right now they're trying this digital pivot, and it's coming at a time when they are, a shell of what they used to be.
Say a bit more about the scope of the layoffs and the departures at the Bee, for example. Do you have numbers for what it was at its peak and what it is now?
I don't have the number in front of me for what it was at its peak, but after the Knight Ridder purchase, and this was the purchase that McClatchy really tried to step into, change American journalism, the history of American journalism, by becoming one of the largest newspaper chains in the country. They made that purchase in 2008, and after that, the economy tanked, and they had their first major round of layoffs, which was like over 1,000. And since then, there's been kind of aftershocks since then. And this latest round of layoffs was 23 people from the overall editorial desk. But that comes a year after another dozen reporters were laid off. So really the Bee, and anyone that gets the Bee, can see that the paper is getting smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. And the staff is getting smaller and smaller.
So Knight Ridder published the Mercury News, the Contra Costa Times, 30 other daily papers. And I'm taking from your article here that the sale marked the second largest takeover in U.S. newspaper history. So McClatchy's final bid was $4.5 billion. It tripled McClatchy's revenue, but it also saddled it with debt. And the number of people who have been laid off, the journalists have said, that factor alone is the most significant in this. But you can't discount the fact that the newspaper, the print industry overall, has shifted dramatically with Google and Facebook. And I think that's where you're getting to in terms of the revenue change, correct?
Yeah. So the economics can get kind of complicated, but the easiest way to understand it is, when was the last time that you went to the newspaper to find a new car or to shop for a pair of shoes? This is what people used to do. But Google and Facebook collectively have taken over 60% of the ad revenue that used to go to newspapers. And newspapers can't compete. These are regional companies, and they're competing with these global companies that can sell ads to retailers like car dealers and like shoe dealers for far cheaper. Over the last 10 years, that would explain this decimation of newspapers. Now, newspapers have suffered major competition before. In the 1920s, it was radio, and newspapers were afraid of that. In the 1950s, it was TV. But without a doubt, this onslaught from Google and Facebook primarily cast newspapers in the biggest competitive assault of their existence.
We're talking around a very important point, and that is that you think of companies like McClatchy as the home base for journalism. But in fact, those companies grew and thrived on a business model that made them really about retail advertisement.
Yeah. I mean, they were just like people say that McDonald's, yes, it's a fast food company, but it's really a real estate company. That's the kind of more secretive way that they make all their money. Newspapers were a delivery service for advertisements, and they had a kind of oligopoly in the U.S. because retailers didn't have a lot of options for where they were going to go. Now you can create, you know, Google keywords and targeted Facebook ads. And to McClatchy's credit, they are getting in on some of this now. They're studying user habits the way that other tech firms do to try to stop the bleeding and grow again. But again, it's a regional company. These are regional companies. And to compete with a global firm is really difficult. And newspapers have another job to do. They've got this whole public service mission that the tech companies don't have.
So there is the journalism side of it. And I think that is the biggest concern, is if Sacramento or any other major city, any city at all, loses its paper of record, it loses some of the documentation, the reporting, the accountability that happens in a community. And it's widely known that McClatchy has been laying off veteran reporters. Who is it hiring then in its place?
Right. So McClatchy has been laying off some of its veteran reporters. Sacramento Bee, as we mentioned recently, laid off some of its veteran reporters. They are hiring younger reporters that are cheaper, and they're hiring technologists to
programmers to get into
VR, virtual reality, and augmented reality. This is the new wave of digital media. We know this. Virtual reality and augmented reality are projected to grow by 100% for the next 4 years. We're seeing Silicon Valley rush into these mediums. And for people that track newspapers, they note with some grievance that newspapers were behind the curve on getting in front of these technological innovations like search engines, like social media, you know, where we go now for what is now Facebook and pictures for Instagram. Newspapers have not gotten in front of this.
It seems like newspapers' rise, though, to its peak revenue kind of was coinciding with the emergence of virtual reality and the digital world. And so their eyes were on their growth at the time and not focused so much on the future. So was there a disconnect at that point?
Well, I think the best way to think of the disconnect for McClatchy is that they've been trying to innovate for the last 10 years, but they've been saddled with this debt because they bought Knight Ridder and they became one of the nation's largest newspaper chains. But the economy tanked, and it's hard to innovate when you are focused on paying off your debt. And that's why they've been seeing cuts. So right now, they have opened this New Ventures Lab. That's their innovation incubator for video and audio augmented reality in downtown Sacramento. And it's exciting. The analyst that I spoke with said, yeah, I mean, they would be remiss to not do this. This is definitely not a dumb idea, right? The question is, do you see it as a glass half full? Is this can really enhance the journalism and bring in new sets of eyeballs? For instance, a just hypothetical example, right now when the Bee covers the proposed Sacramento streetcar, they will do a print piece on the streetcar, and then reporter Tony Bijak has done a video on another streetcar, successful streetcar elsewhere. Well, imagine being able to hold up your phone and seeing a computer-generated streetcar rolling down K Street, giving the viewer a whole new sense of what that project could be. You know, McClatchy has done all kinds of innovative projects around this, and the medium is being used to talk about human rights abuses. And
print piece, would a written piece go along with that?
McClatchy does not want to get rid of its trenchant public interest reporting, but and they say this new world will enhance the journalism. Some of the old school kind of journalistic purists saying, yeah, but at the same time, you're cutting veteran staff with institutional knowledge to bring on these new people. And there's a public service role that McClatchy and the Bee have traditionally had over its 160-year history. And will that be diminished, at least, if resources are going into something else?
Where is that connection with the people in your community who know your community? You know, the human connection, that body of knowledge that the reporters had from spending decades in a community, knowing sources. I think it's so hard to think that won't continue to have a place. It's something like valuing the wisdom of your elders, perhaps.
Well, so if the Bee were to go away, and we don't know that that's going to happen in our lifetime, it could happen in a few years, it could happen in a decade, it could be around another 160 years, but at some point something will replace the Sacramento Bee. The question is, will that entity have the same public service mission? Will they be able to not prioritize profits to the extent that they're serving the public need? Mm. You know, there are other outlets. Capital Public Radio is doing great work here, but there's something to be said about a newspaper of record. A newspaper of record really has two missions in a community. One is to help people understand how society is being built up around them and how individuals can participate and influence that buildup. And the other is to hold leaders accountable. The first mission, if you want to be charitable, you could argue, could be taken care of by social media. If everyone is tweeting all the time, every time there's a shooting or a protest or at a public meeting, that is a way to stay informed. It's just taking the journalist out of the equation. The second mission, though, holding leaders accountable. What happens when there's these backroom deals? What happens when no one is out there tweeting or saying anything public about that? What happens when a newspaper leaves a community? One of the best recent case studies in this is what happened with the city of Bell in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So Bell was in one of the poorest cities in L.A. County. They had a newspaper, the Industrial Post, that went under in the late 90s. And in 2005, there's a city administrator, Robert Rizzo, helped pass this measure that took the limits off of what city administrators and city officials could pay themselves, right? No one was covering this. The measure passed by 336 votes in a community of 30,000 people. By the time the LA Times caught up to the story in 2010, Rizzo was making $1.5 million a year at a time when the recession was at its apex, right? There wasn't a journalist covering City Hall in Bell. And every time a newspaper cuts their staff, there's less people to cover school board hearings and water rights hearings and legislative and city committees and subcommittees. So as McClatchy enters into this brave new world of digital journalism, there's that question, will they have the resources to be a public watchdog?
But when the LA Times did catch up to it, their reporting was awarded prizes, including, I believe, a Pulitzer Prize, because then there was a public record and an accounting of what happened. And of course, the Bell story then became public. Then there was prosecution and consequence after that. I do have to say that every time we lay out one fact about what's happening, there's sort of the counterfact, because we're in these two worlds right now. And the newspaper circulation has fallen by more than 52%. You write that in your article. At the same time, the number of visitors to the website has grown. Digital circulation is up almost 200%, certainly from a decade ago. So I think that it's just when the lines intersect, how fast might the company grow at this rate? Because the tech world, the tech industry, and so many industries is growing rapidly.
Yeah. What I think is important to remember is that one can't take the function of newspapers for granted. I say the function of newspapers because we don't know how long newspapers will be around. People at the highest levels of this industry aren't expecting a resurgence of newspapers, right? But there really is this responsibility on the public to find out what you care about as far as news and how you're going to get it. You know, in the face of all this destruction of newspapers, one might draw some optimism from what happened with food, the farm to fork movement. Mm. This is a comparison drawn by Franklin Foyer of The Atlantic. So there was obviously major problems in the food supply chain. And we started getting a lot of outreach, a lot of documentaries and books about what was going on and how it was causing problems with individuals, right? Mm. And all of a sudden, farming became cool again. Farmers markets became cool again. Eating local became cool again. And the food advocates started saying, get to know your local farmer. I think if you're a news advocate, the message is, get to know your local journalist. There's people doing great work.
I can hear them right now saying, but we don't have jobs. Right. A lot of us are great local journalists. We just don't have a landing spot right now.
It's true. People are really struggling. That said, there's great work going on in this town. You guys at Capital Public Radio are doing great work. The B, you know, for this tumult that it's in, has reporters that are working every day really hard to put out great journalism. Comstock's Magazine, Sacramento Business Journal, Sacramento News and Review, the three TV, big TV networks. Get to know these individual reporters. They're on Twitter. They're on Facebook. And let them know how stories that they're missing. Let them know facts that they missed, other stuff going on. You know, to me, journalism is like democracy. It only works properly if everyone is paying attention.
The doorway is wide open for entities that can be the voice of record. And certainly here in radio, I will say that we're thinking more than ever before about being that daily voice and having the agenda for covering the daily news in a different, more aggressive way. I hope that we get to a good place. In your food analogy, where we're getting to is power in the hands of the people for what we take in, what we eat, and what we enjoy. And I hope you're right. I hope that the same thing happens with journalism in the many ways that we can get it.
I do. Yeah.
Amen.
You. Yeah.
That's an amen.
Yeah.
All right, Alan. Thanks so much. We are going to post a link to your article in Comstocks, also a link to your website so people can see the freelance work that you've been doing and the number of stories you've been covering.
That's great. Yeah. Comstocks is available at Barnes & Noble and Nugget, and it's comstocksmag.com. The story I wrote, it looks at the past, present, and future of McClatchy and the Sacramento Bee. It really was this American staple. You know, I'll just finish with this. In its prime, if you lived anywhere in California off the coast, the Bee was where you received your news. You know, it was. I write that the internet was delivered to your doorstep every day, and it came in the form of the Sacramento Bee. It was available from the Oregon border to San Diego border or Mexico border. So no matter what happens with McClatchy and the Bee, I think it's important to look at this Sacramento company that's almost as old as the city itself that rose to become one of the nation's largest newspaper chains and to bookend that that American staple.
You wrote, love it or hate it, the Bee was fundamental to the California experience. For now, it still is. Thanks, Alan.
Thank you.
That is freelance reporter Alan Young, and you can find the links, as we've just discussed, at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio, I'm Beth Ruriak. Mary Stuart is a play that premiered, back in 1800. It was written by Friedrich Schiller, first as a verse play about the rivalry between Queen Elizabeth I of England and her cousin Mary, Queen of Scots. Mary Stuart is one of two plays featured in this summer's Davis Shakespeare Festival, which has opened and continues through August. And though they are silent, I have a crowd in the studio at the moment. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome. Glad to have you here. So introductions, please. Rob, do you want to start?
Oh, yeah. I'm Rob Salas. I'm an artistic director at Davis Shakespeare Festival.
I'm Gia Batista. I'm the other co-artistic director of Davis Shakespeare Festival.
Rob is directing Mary Stuart, by the way. And Gia, you're directing the other play this summer, which is?
On the 20th Century.
There we go. Okay. Sharon, you're next.
Yes. I'm Sharon Reedkirk. I'm an actor. I'll be playing Mary Stuart in Mary Stuart. And I'll be playing Lily Garland in On the 20th Century. So I'm doing double duty.
And Jamie, welcome back.
Hi. Jamie Jones. And I'm playing Queen Elizabeth in Mary Stuart. My voice is really low.
It is. For you.
My morning voice.
Are you working on that? So we have two plays and we have really powerful female characters, don't we?
Yes, we
yeah.
do.
Jamie, your take on that, because when you get a role like this, like Elizabeth, you must just grab on with everything, every toolbox talent you have.
Yeah, and this is a tough one. I mean, it's a huge language play. It's a five-act play. It's in verse as well as in prose. I started working on this just because my tired old mind can't hold on to things, lines like it used to. So I've been working on it for quite some time, but I'm in great company and Sharon has just been terrific. She's a fabulous rival, but a good friend. So, yeah, but it takes a lot. I sleep a lot during the day.
Sharon, what about these historical, larger-than-life characters in today's world and with today's audiences?
I think they're still so very relevant. I mean, they're women fighting desperately for what they believe in, for their rights, for their viewpoint. And what's really beautiful about this play is that they have a moment of coming together to really hash it out and try to reach in to touch the other woman's heart. And the outcome of that is beyond them, per se. But but I think there's something to be said about communication or the lack thereof and understanding someone who's different from you that I think is a story we should be listening to right now.
And also trying to live in a man's world, really.
Yes. Yes.
And how difficult that is for both of these women.
So, Rob, it would be easy to say, oh, these political times that we're in, you must have been very intentional in choosing the plays with that in mind. But what was some of the behind the scenes between you and Gia in making this decision?
Well, we absolutely were thinking about the times. I think it's just a moment where we're considering these things of what happened, you know, what are the implications of women in leadership, and what are the trials and tribulations that come with it. This play explores that. It's like you said, from 1800, but it explores it in such a genius way. And because we have two powerful women, but they're kind of opposites, in that Elizabeth is this politically savvy, very modern kind of leader, and Mary represents kind of more of this idealism and romanticism. And when the two meet, it is truly one of the greatest scenes, I think, in dramatic history. It's just a great, great play.
I know we're going to hear a scene. I don't know if that's it. Rob just set it up so beautifully. But do you want to position it in the play for me a bit before you step into it?
Sure. This is the one moment they have of coming together right smack dab in the middle of the play. And they're completely at odds with each other, and their circumstances could not be more polar.
And it's something of a surprise to Mary.
Yes.
That it's happening as quickly as it is. She's attempted to communicate and hoped for this meeting, but now that it's here,
she's unprepared.
All right, so here they are, Sharon Reed Kirk as Mary and Jamie Jones as Queen Elizabeth from the play Mary Stuart, which is being produced this summer by Davis Shakespeare Festival.
Who tells me that this woman is unhappy, my lords? I see a proud and upright person, not in the least bit humbled by misfortune.
Destiny has decided in your favor, sister. I kneel to the eternal power that has raised you, but you must do the same for me. Be gracious, sister. Do not leave me lying dishonored in the dust. Reach down your royal right hand to raise me. I have fallen a long way down.
Stay down there, Lady Mary. It is your place. And I thank God in heaven it was not his sovereign will that I should kneel to you as you now kneel to me.
Do not forget that nothing stands forever, that there are gods who punish pride. The proof is at your feet. In front of witnesses, do not destroy the good name of the Tudors whose blood we share. Dear God, do not stand there stern and aloof, a proud sea cliff rebuffing this shipwrecked woman. My whole life is hanging on what my words or tears can do. I call everything that is in me to appeal to everything that is in you, but your ice face freezes my speech.
What did you want to say? You asked to see me. So I laid aside the indignation of an injured queen in order to fulfill the sacred duty of sisterhood and to provide you with the consolation of my presence, bending to a will of generosity by which I have exposed myself to blame for stepping in the mud because you wanted to have me murdered.
Jamie Jones and Sharon Reed Kirk. That's from the Davis Shakespeare Festival production of Mary Stuart, which opened last weekend. Director Rob Salas is here, along with Gia Battista. Tell me about the performances. So Thursdays through Saturdays?
Yeah, Thursdays through Sundays. And then we have matinees on Saturdays and Sundays. And then from Thursday to Saturday, yeah, it's at 8 o'clock. Yeah.
Okay, and now I'm taking a breath about hearing your language and feeling your presence with each other and the high intensity that you need for these shows. Yeah, it was almost like I had to move to some logistics to be able to kind of process what I just heard. Did you two know each other before this production?
We did. We've never worked together. We have mutual friends.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I've seen Jamie's work, and I'm
Sacramento
a big fan.
Is lucky to have you, the two dynamos, doing theater. And Gia, people might be less familiar with the play you're directing. So will you talk a bit about On the 20th Century?
Absolutely. On the 20th Century is just a thrill. It falls between, it's like a musical and an operetta and a farce all rolled into one. And it is, it's just been such a blast to work on. It's definitely, I'd say, our largest undertaking in terms of production size and absolutely quality. I mean, it's just been the demands that it asks for. Vocally and musically have just been, it's been really a thrill to listen to. And I think it really is going to take some breaths away for sure.
You have the role, Sharon, that I think Kristen Chenoweth had.
Yes.
That's right.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Are you ready to do some singing here for us?
If you've got the music, I'm ready to sing.
Oh, that's such a great answer. I love that answer. So are we able to do this? We're going to try.
All right.
Okay. So here is Sharon Reed-Kirk, and your character's Lily.
Lily,
correct?
Garland. She's a movie star.
Okay. She's going to be big diva here.
Yes. They're trying to get her to sign a contract, and she is very much not into that idea.
Okay. This is from the show On the 20th Century Places, everyone.
Let me see. Let me see, when would I be available? When would I be free? March, September, June, November, 1933, 1934, 1935, 1936, never. Never, that is the word I use. Never, that is the word I choose. Tell him you really tried. Tell him that really I'd rather die. Never, never is much too quick. Never, he makes me much too sick. Let him save his own hateful hide. Let him know he's so hateful. I'd rather die.
A little different from Mary Stewart, don't you think?
I wish. Were you seeing Jamie at all during
that?
No,
I had to close my eyes and focus.
She was clenching her fists and holding on for dear life. And
see,
Rob,
this is what's so great about having women in the room. They're so supportive of each other. And yes.
Rob and Gia are just sitting back with this look like, yeah, we got them. We got that talent in Davis this summer. Okay, a little more about On the 20th Century, because some of the cast overlaps. Jamie, not in that one. All right.
I wish.
Yeah, yeah. But just the expanse of people in these shows. Gia?
Yeah, so we do have some overlap. On the 20th does require a larger ensemble of amazing talent, people from Davis, Sacramento, Bay Area. We've just been thrilled to work with everybody, newcomers and past ensemble members are returning. And this is just such a thrilling play. And I think in terms of the theme of strong women, I think in our programming, we really do try to choose plays that really do showcase strong female characters. And for these two shows, you know, very, very different. On the 20th is hysterical. And however, it does follow the lead female character, Lily Garland. And she, in her way, like Mary and Elizabeth, is very strong and powerful.
I'm going to test that because we're almost out of time. Uh-huh. Can you just, like this, hit that note, Sharon?
Oh, my God.
Can you just nail it?
I mean, I could, but you just made me so nervous.
I did.
Should we tempt fate and let me do it twice?
We should.
Oh gosh, I don't know.
Right
I think
now.
If you want to hear that note again, y'all better pony up some dollars and get down to Davis.
Oh, she's so good.
And listen to the rest of the town.
Okay.
Well.
The Davis Shakespeare Festival is at the Veterans Memorial Center Theater in Davis. Shows are Thursday through Sunday. We'll post a link. Thank you, everybody.
Thank
Rob,
you.
Gia, Sharon, Jamie.
So
good luck
much.
This summer. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruriak. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.